Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. A few weeks ago, I was privileged to have Tim Cruthers, the author of The Man Watching, a biography of Anson Durant, the unlikely architect of the greatest college sports dynasty ever. Well, that was the title, and Tim Cruthers was the author, and he gave us a good inside look at his book and at the subject of his book, Anson Durant. And he, after it was over, he said, "Would D.G., sometime maybe we could get Anson to come out and talk about these matters." And I thought, unlikely. But Tim, you did it, and you got Anson to
come. I recruited him for you.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure for me to be here as well.
Thanks. Well, talking about the book, and we won't go through the whole title. You broke the first rule of book authorship, which is to have a short four-letter title.
Exactly.
If you wanna. But what's been the reaction to your book?
Well, it's been out now about a year's time, and I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed about it is that Anson sends me emails that he receives, letters he receives, tells me about phone calls that he receives, and even after a year's time, we're still getting an incredible amount of positive reaction about the book. And the story I love to tell is a story about a 1 week's time last spring, where we had a series of incredibly positive reactions to the book. The first one actually came from an Iraq war veteran who had read the book, and he said it sort of restored restored the value of leadership in his mind. And then 2 days later, we had a 16-page handwritten letter from a young coach in Florida, who's a high school coach, who was considering giving up his dream of becoming a coach. And then he read the book and decided that it restored for him the value of what it is to mentor kids and be a leader also. And then a couple days after that, I mean, these things just kept coming in. A couple days after that, we got a letter from a neurosurgeon over at Duke, who also is a professor. And he had read the book, and he said it helped him gave him some ideas about how to mentor men versus mentoring women, which is a big subject in the book, how you lead them differently. And then finally, 2 days after that, we got a call from somebody, a high school senior in Pennsylvania, who was the valedictorian of her class. And she gave her commencement speech shortly after reading the book and just read excerpts from the book out of the book for her commencement speech, and told us that there was not a dry eye in the house.
Oh, my golly, that's the highest compliment.
So, yeah, I mean, of the four, that's probably the one that hits home the most. But it's just interesting to see how it affects different people in different places.
Well, Tim, before we bring Anson into the conversation on the reactions, I was real interested in this comment from the Duke professor or the Duke doctor. Mm-hmm. Was he a surgeon?
He's a neurosurgeon, a brain surgeon, yeah.
You think of, you can see Anson Durant's as the decisive brain surgeon who will make those decisions, the spot decisions, and most of them will be right, some of them will be wrong, but you work through
it's not quite as life and death in his case.
Well, it's pretty important for some of us. It's pretty important, but the entry of women into athletics during the last 35 years. Is probably analogous to the entry of women as surgeons into the operating room, where they are not welcome initially and have to adjust. And so these old white guys who are leading, mentoring these young women who, if you pushed them, they'd say they didn't really think ought to be there. Mm-hmm. They have to, or Anson teaches them something in that you do, if you treat them the way they should be treated, they will perform. I mean, was that sort of his message?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the best from what he said in his letter, you do have to. There are certain hurdles that women have to overcome, just in terms of competitiveness to some extent, similarly to what goes on the soccer field, and competing against each other and against the men in their classes. They try to climb the ladder of in surgery. And I think Anson breaks down in the book, step by step, the things he learned largely through making mistakes about how you have to treat men and women differently in mentoring them. And I think what this Duke surgeon was talking about was he to some extent, tried to treat them all, to all of his students, the same way. And he's learned over the years that you have to treat men and women a bit differently in terms of mentoring them. And he picked up some ideas from the book about how Anson has done it, because he was a former men's coach also. And so he's had to learn those things as well.
Well, Anson Dress, what's been your reaction to this book?
Well, as Tim knows, I agreed to do it because I felt if it was an honest portrayal of our program, it would help us recruit. It has helped us recruit. I think even this unvarnished review of the program has been very powerful, and it's made a difference in recruiting. I mean, let's face it, there's a much more competitive landscape out there now for us, and so we're looking for every edge possible. And I think what this does for us, believe it or not, is it puts a more human face on the program. A lot of the ways that our competitors recruit against us is their presumption is that because of all the success we've had, it couldn't be any fun. And there's nothing further from the truth. Or because of this quality that we exhibit when we play, that we've got this tremendous competitive fire and we play with an extraordinary competitive nature, they also feel like, well, nurturing that certainly couldn't be the sort of environment any kid would want to play in. And they recruit with that sort of, anti-Carolina sort of negative recruiting platform. And the thing the book does right out of the gate is it completely dissolves that opinion. Certainly with the way we cherish these players, doesn't mean we're not driving them, but what the book has is a wonderful balance between this competitive cauldron we set up for their athletic development and this sort of supportive system for their human development. And the book, I think, is very good about sharing that balance, and it sort of undermines almost all the negative recruiting that's out there against us. And it's a powerful recruiting force for us, and I appreciate that quality in the book.
Well, Tim writes in his book, and I wondered, I challenge your sincerity in this, is that you like it when other programs succeed, even though they're challenging the dominance of the Carolina soccer program, because you want the United States to have a great soccer program. So even these guys who are out there competing against you, perhaps, would you say unfairly, you want those guys' programs to be better too?
Well, I just want to raise the entire level of the American women's game. First and foremost, I would love for us to continue to dominate the international game. And in every clinic I've given, we've shared absolutely everything we do. I think there's some coaches out there that really feel like they've got all these secrets they have to protect, and they don't really share that much. And we've shared everything. We've shared everything from day one about everything that we do. And one of the motivations, actually, is to see what people's reaction is, sort of like as a point and counterpoint. We're going to do this, and I want to hear what you're going to do when I do this. And it's for us to continue to improve, but also because we want to share anything we've learned, because we want everyone out there to keep getting better. I think that's an obligation all of us have in any leadership position, to share all the things that we feel are true. And I think people appreciate it, and I think it makes us all better. And hopefully this will help us continue to evolve. But we've never hidden anything from anyone. And, of course, I owe a lot of people in my past that have opened themselves up in their program, certainly starting with Dean Smith, about everything he's done to make his teams and players better. And I think we've all got an obligation to share everything we can with everyone we can.
Well, another thing that Tim brought up is in your relationships with the other coaches and the other people in the other programs is that from time to time, every now and then, one of them might suggest that Anson Durant was arrogant. Tim, do you think, is he really arrogant? And what are the consequences of that trait?
Well, I guess my favorite story about this is that I think the one moment of every game that maybe ticks off some of his fellow coaches is when he walks out onto the field, and there's you can sort of see it on the book cover. There's a certain stern, almost regal
He's
way.
He's almost projecting it right now. I mean, I wish that the people listening on the radio could see him.
And the funny thing is, I don't know that I'm sure he doesn't see it that way, but I think a lot of people who do see him from the outside and don't know him well just sort of see that just in his day-to-day. He does have a bit of – we talked about how he has this very Anglophile colonial background, and occasionally I think that comes out in his speech, but mostly I think it's just in his carriage. And when he walks out –
You think it's the way he walks out onto the field rather than in anything he says or does along the way?
More coaches brought that up just out of the blue. I'm just telling you what I heard from other coaches.
Why ask you if you shared that view?
I think when I first saw him do his work, I probably did see a little bit of that. And it's only after speaking to him and him telling me that that particular moment is probably his moment of greatest doubt in a game, in the process of his job, because here's where a game is about to start, and he's analyzing his team and sort of how they're warming up, and you can learn a lot from how your team warms up, and sometimes if they're warming up poorly, you begin to wonder whether their heads are really in the game for that game, and you start watching the other team, and you realize, you know, their goalie's pretty good, and, you know, she's stopping a lot of shots here in the warm-up, and they got some personality players who can really do some interesting things on the ball, and you know, I'm beginning to wonder whether we really can win this game. And when he told me that, now I watch him in a whole different way. I see him walk out of the field.
Him?
And I know that's what's going on in his mind. I think, well...
You believe him? Or do you think that was just kind of a cover story to say, hey, I'm really at a moment of great doubt? I mean, I
try to put myself in his shoes and in those moments. And I always think going into a game, and especially when I started... the early years of researching the book, I used to think, Carolina, why would they ever lose a game? I mean, they're so strong. Here's their record. They have all these things. They have all this talent. And then you begin to watch the game and you realize how fragile the game of soccer is and how, I mean, you can lose any game despite the fact that you might outshoot the other team 30-1. I do understand now because I have those same doubts that I didn't used to have when I began the program that, almost any game that Carolina plays, I feel they could lose.
Let's ask you this: were you just trying to bring him along, or are you really not? Aren't you really arrogant when you go out there and you want to project that to the other coaches and to your team that you have supreme confidence? Mm-hmm. Don't you? I mean, this is just a cover up, isn't it?
No, I mean I've never felt arrogant, and I guess I've always been a little bit irritated. There's a presumption out there that I am. I mean, I think arrogance is someone reading my mind. And isn't that a little bit presumptuous? I mean, I think I'm certainly very confident, but I just, I you know, this arrogant thing for me just doesn't seem to hold true. And I know that it absolutely drives my wife nuts when someone makes these statements, because obviously she's married to me and has been with me for quite a long time, and I don't think she would ever say that.
Really? I mean, she wouldn't? I mean, golly,
no.
You know, in a lot of marriages, I know the two partners are accusing each other of arrogance.
No, I know this is true because whenever she reads it, and obviously I don't try to take her stuff that would drive her crazy, but there's certainly enough stuff that's written about our program out there that she gets to read. And I think that, above anything else, just makes her very angry. Mm. That's certainly not the way I feel. Tim's right. I know how fragile victory is in our game. I know that even in dominating, there's a possibility you're going to lose. In fact, this recent season is a tremendous example of that. We beat almost all the good teams on our schedule and lost to teams that weren't as good as we were. By the example that Tim gave, in one game we outshot, I think, one team 27-1 and lost on their one shot. So the game is fraught with peril. I'm very humble about how difficult it is to win. And I'm always shocked when people think that any victory in our game is easy or taken for granted. In fact, one of the things that drives me most crazy is the presumption that someone has before a game that we're going to win it. And that actually angers me a bit, that someone feels like, well, this is a game certainly you're going to win. And I'm thinking, you know, how little this person knows about athletics and soccer. and sport in general. I mean, one of the things that makes the sport world fascinating is these teams that are upset all the time. I mean, the great story this year in football was, what, Appalachian State going up and beating Michigan? I mean, this is what sport's all about for these kinds of events. And so, I don't go into any game really feeling like we're going to win. When I look at my team, I see all of its weaknesses. When I look at an opponent, I see all their strengths. And maybe that's a quality that's helped us become effective in competing, because we don't suffer from hubris when we play. And one of the things I love about coaching women is, relative to men, they don't suffer from hubris when they're competing. And I enjoy that humility in an athlete. One of the reasons I selected to coach the women was this difference in athletic character. I think the women are a lot more humble about their athletic achievements. And I think women in general lose fewer games because of hubris than men.
Well, we're talking mm-hmm. with Tim Cruthers, the author of The Man Watching, the biography of Anson Durrance, and we're talking with Anson Durrance, and we'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests are Tim Cruthers, the author of The Man Watching. This is the biography of Anson Durrance. And Tim, we talked about this a few weeks ago. We're now privileged to have with us Anson Durrance, who can come challenge whatever you might have said in the book that he doesn't agree with. What was your reaction, Anson, when you opened up this book, or did Tim let you approve every page before he said?
No, I mean, I knew the best way to make this book credible was to set him free, and so I set him free. I was convinced that if he was free, and free to call anyone, write anything in the book, do anything he wanted, I was pretty confident that the book would still come out as a positive thing for our program. So I was pretty confident that even setting him free, we were gonna be fine. I was also pretty confident that if he called anyone in the program or spoke to anyone out there, that we would also still be fine. So I had no qualms about setting him free to write it. And then my first review of the book actually wasn't me reading it. It was my wife reading it in bed next to me. And, of course, so we do all of our reading before we sleep at night. And she kept wanting to read me passages out of the book, and she kept laughing the whole time and saying, Anson, I got to read this to you. I said, no, honey, I want to read it myself. You know, please. No, let me read this to you. And half the time she would end up, blurting out something that had happened. And obviously, when she's enjoying the book and laughing about it all the way through it, I knew it was going to be fine. And obviously, the best critic of the book is certainly going to be my wife, because she, protects me like a hawk. So I knew if she liked it, that I was going to like it as well. And sure enough, as I was reading it, I had the same feeling that she did. The program comes through. What comes through is basically we don't take ourselves that seriously. So this arrogant charge, I think, is dismissed pretty easily in the book. A lot of what we do is incredible fun, and I think that comes across in the book. I think we also cherish the kids that play for us. That comes across in the book. We also want to develop these hardened female warriors, and that comes across in the book. I think all the things that I was hoping would come across in the book did. And it certainly cleared the potentially greatest critic of the book, which was my wife. And it passed her in the first reading that she had, where she was trying to share everything with me. So I was very happy with the book.
Well, there's a downside to this really good feeling that you and your wife have about the book, and that you're feeling that it helps the program. And, Tim, you got to wrestle with the natural question is, didn't you sell out when you wrote this book because Anson likes it so much? Mm-hmm. None of us are so good that we ought to like the honest report of who we are and what we're like. I mean, doesn't that give you a little pause?
No question that you, my intention going into the book was that this become, that this be an objective take on the program. And I didn't want to write a puff book. I think one of the things that I dislike about almost all sports books out there are they are puff books. And we talk about if you'd write a book about, say, a football coach or a basketball coach, in most cases, you're not going to have full access. And that's what ends
you're
up turning.
Managed. You're managed.
Yeah. by them, by their staff,
Was there a model, Tim, of a book that had been written previously about a sports figure that you that gave you confidence that it could be done if you had that right kind of access?
A Season on the Brink, the book that many people have read, that John Feinstein wrote about Bobby Knight and the Indiana program. And I knew that this, or I suspected that this program was not going to have as much natural controversy as that one had, the idea that Bobby Knight somehow, and I still don't know why he did this to this day, said, John, you can come in and have the same access that Anson afforded me.
I don't want to get in the middle of something that I really don't know enough about to talk about, but people accuse Bobby Knight of being arrogant as well, and the kind of arrogance that is, come look at me, my doors are open, and with the supreme self-confidence that there's nothing wrong with me, kind of like Anson. Mm-hmm. Come look at me, it turns out that the things that Bobby Knight thought were great were things that, as other people looked at them, were not.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not really quite the
I might argue I that I don't know that he did. I think the access that he gave John Feinstein was unusual. I think he, like most basketball coaches, I think naturally was very protective of his program, and I don't think he allowed, until that moment, somebody to come in. I think he trusted John Feinstein. John Feinstein had written a lot of stories for the Washington Post about his program. They'd had a long-term relationship for journalists to coach. And I think he felt that Feinstein would come in and do the book that Knight wanted him to do, and therefore gave him the full access. And I think if you talked, and again, I don't know the inside of it either, but I think if you talked to Bobby Knight about Season on the Brink, he would tell you that it went further toward the truth than he would have preferred. That it wasn't the book that he expected it to be, because the way Bobby Knight operates, that sort of totalitarian program.
Well, I guess that a coach has the like a political figure. Mm-hmm. If you write about me the things that make me look bad, I'm never going to give you the kind of access that you've got right now.
Sure.
But if you make me look good, we can have a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this: in looking back on the book, now a year since it was first published, and more than a year since you had to give it up to publishers, what's changed about the Carolina program or the facts and circumstances that you would have liked to have included, or did you feel like you don't want to go back to that?
Well, to be honest with you, I worked on this beginning in 2001. The summer of 2001 is when I started the reporting, and I thought I would spend 6 months reporting it, report through one season, essentially, from them beginning practice in August through their season ending in December. And hopefully they'd win the national championship, and I'd write the book in the next 6 months, and we'd publish it after a year's time. And what I realized was I couldn't understand everything in that short a period of time. And it's very difficult to grasp everything that's going on. And I didn't, I wasn't a huge women's soccer fan. I didn't have a lot of background going in. So I was really learning on the job. And so over the course of the years, I realized I was getting it more and more, to the point where I'm still, I'm still a rank amateur in terms of watching a soccer game, but I know a heck of a lot more than I did in 2001. And I just know a lot more about the program. It's amazing how the girls who I spoke with on the team in 2001, I would interview them again 2 or 3 years later, freshmen becoming seniors. All of a sudden, they're telling me so much more than they were willing to tell me in 2001. So you gain so much by just spending time around the program. And I was actually a volunteer coach for one of their seasons because I wanted to see everything that goes on behind the scenes. I sort of George Plimpton'd it a little bit when I started running fitness with them. I tried to figure out, I wanted to experience every little bit of the program, and it was only the amount of time I had to do it that allowed me to get that. And so, looking back, to be honest, I wish I could give you
no something that I'm necessary.
No, I mean, obviously, I reported this for 5 years. Two-thirds, there's another book and a half that I could have written, and I was looking through some stuff the other day about stuff that I'd cut out of the book that kills me. I wish I could have put it in.
Well, we'll figure out a way. Yeah. We'll figure out a way. Listen, we need to take a break. Mm-hmm. Talking with Tim Cruthers, the author of the biography of Anson Durance called The Man Watching, and when we come back, we're going to visit with Coach Durance himself. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Tim Cruthers wrote a book about Anson Durance, and we talked about it earlier. Now we've got Coach Durance in the studio with us to defend himself, but I guess to celebrate that you got out alive out of a pretty long, hard look. That's got to make you feel pretty good.
I was hoping the book would help us recruit. It does. And I guess I'm just not paranoid. I'm sitting here listening to you thinking, my gosh, this guy must be paranoid as can be. I mean, I can't imagine anyone that would feel that if someone really scrutinized their life, they would have to, you know, hide everything and, you know, close closets. I don't feel paranoid. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe most people are. I'm just not. I'm also not very thin-skinned. Maybe most people are. I'm not. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have all these huge fears and didn't feel like, you know, we had to guide him in a certain direction. I'm very trusting. I think that comes out in the book. And I absolutely trusted him. I've been burned by the media, but I go back to trusting it. I just don't have all these fears.
Let's talk about this for just a minute, about being burned by the media and then coming back and trusting them again. And give us, what was the worst burning that you ever suffered? And then how did you come back and trust the guys who burned you?
Well, certainly the ongoing lawsuit, certainly gives me and my family pause to trust anyone.
Absolutely.
Thankfully, the leadership we had at the university embraced me and my family. I mean, the chancellor, Michael Hooker, and his wife, Carmen, jumped in along with Dickie Bedore, my boss and athletic director. And you know what? Maybe there's a wonderful lesson in that kind of leadership, certainly in light of, the tragedy over at Duke, and not just what happened, but everyone's reaction to it. I think there would be a wonderful cautionary tale for any leader out there about, supporting the people that work for them. I mean, I think between our chancellors here and our leadership in the athletic department, I've always felt incredibly supported. Even by the state attorney general's office, I've been completely supported. Maybe this trust I have in humanity is well-founded.
I hate to interrupt you. This is so important. Mm-hmm. I think everybody will be glad to hear that. But the question is about the media burning you. Mm-hmm. When did you get burned and how? And then you asserted that you then came back to a trusting relationship with those who burned you, and can you document that?
I think what's kind of interesting, and maybe the best way to look at this, is through the Duke lacrosse case. I mean, what's fascinating about watching a very powerful media entity in the state of North Carolina, like the News and Observer, is to watch them, you know, tear Duke apart while all this was going on, and then go through this incredible period of mea culpas following the event.
Yeah, but what I was talking about you, I'm talking about you, and did you really ever get burned by the media in a way that you had to take a deep breath and come back and
Well, I guess what I'm trying to share with you is the story. I mean, and I'm not going to, you know, point fingers because I think that's a part of, you know, becoming paranoid. But I think what the media ultimately ends up doing eventually, certainly when they're exposed to being completely wrong about something, is like any, you know, great collection of people that jump on bandwagons, they jump on the bandwagon as soon as possible. So I think what ends up happening is the media self-correcting, certainly when things are proven completely wrong that they were writing about. And I think one of the reasons is because they are in the public eye. I think eventually humanity brings them back. And I think a part of what I cherish about, I guess, all of us as human beings is I think we're basically good. I think I coach from that perspective. And I think one of the things that ends up serving us well as coaches in our program is we root for the kids. And I don't feel like, you know, things are going to continue to be negative in the media about anything. And so,
right. Well, that's a great philosophy. Mm-hmm. I have to confess that I give up trying to get you to answer that question. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. We're going to stop talking about all that. Mm-hmm. Get Anson to tell us a little bit about what life was like for him growing up, a really great part of the story that Tim Cruthers told in his book, The Man Watching. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests are Tim Cruthers, the author of The Man Watching. That's a biography of Anson Dorrance, and he's brought Coach Dorrance in to talk to us both about the book and then about some of the things that were a part of the book. So many pieces of the book that fascinated me, Tim, and one of them was about Anson's early life and growing up. And I thought you wove together a compelling story about if you're trying to explain how this coach might be a little bit different from other coaches and mm-hmm. maybe from the rest of us that look at his background growing up. And Anson, I wondered, as you read that story about growing up, do you feel like that the kind of living around the world, the only people whom I know who have this kind of rich experience are you and Barack Obama? I mean, you just lived everywhere.
Well, there's no question. I really feel privileged to have had opportunity.
Tell us just in a word about your trip around the world.
Well, I was born in Bombay, India, an oil industry family. My father worked at first for Exxon, and then Standard Oil, and then when the monopoly was broken, he ended up working for Mobil when Standard Oil split into Esso and Mobil. And we were transferred every 3 years, and in between those three-year transfers, we'd spend 6 months on a tobacco farm in Lewisburg, North Carolina. So we went from Bombay to Calcutta to Nairobi, Kenya to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia to Singapore, Malaysia. And then we had a stint in the United States between Lewisburg, North Carolina, White Plains, New York. And in between the Ethiopia-Singapore adventure, we had 6 months in Oakland, California. And then following White Plains, we moved to Brussels, Belgium. While my parents were there, I was sent to a Swiss boarding school in Fribourg, Switzerland. And following graduation, went to a college that was run by the same Catholic teaching order that ran my boarding school, the Marianist Order, went to St. Mary's in San Antonio, Texas, spent one semester there, and then transferred to the University of North Carolina. And, of course, I've been in Chapel Hill ever since and came here in 1970 in the spring and absolutely loved the school, loved the town, got married the summer I graduated with the idea that I was going to move to Chapel Hill without any job prospects in the world. I was an English and philosophy major, and, of course, that meant you were qualified to bus tables at the Carolina Coffee Shop. So that was my plan. I was just going to figure out a way to hack out an existence in Chapel Hill. Fortunately, my wife had some talent, was hired immediately to teach a dance for initially Bounds Dance Studio. And then she started her own studio and then ultimately ended up running the Duke Undergraduate Dance Program, which she's retiring from this month. And we've just absolutely loved being a part of this community in every respect. I love you know, being the tip of the sword in women's soccer for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I can't think of a more noble thing for me to be doing to represent my great university and to be out there, you know, basically a part of this community. So we lived all over the place. My wife was born in Lisbon, Portugal, so our backgrounds are similar in that respect. We met as second graders in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Her older brother was my best white friend in Ethiopia. And, of course, this was the younger sister. I've had a crush on her since she's been in the second grade. So marrying her was, you know, obviously a wonderful thing for me, certainly. Maybe I have to ask her whether it was as good for her. And we've absolutely thoroughly enjoyed raising our children in this tremendous community, and I just love representing the university.
There's a wonderful picture in the book. I think it's the first picture. There's a center section of photos in the book of taken in Addis Ababa, where it's a costume party. And Anson is dressed as a popcorn salesman, and Melissa is dressed as a ballerina. And you think to yourself, their career goals were already set. I mean, Anson's been selling ever since in one way, shape, or form, and Melissa has made her life's work as a ballerina.
I just have to say, I just missed that, and that's worth the price of the book itself. Mm-hmm. Just that picture of these, you know, settled down Chapel Hill.
Right,
ideal couple in Addis Ababa.
Right, what a strange existence to live, where you spend 20 years as a nomad going all around the world. And I found this so fascinating too that I wanted to report it as thoroughly as I possibly could. And then he spent 35 years, essentially the last 35 years, in Chapel Hill. And
well, the other part of this, and I'm so tempted to just spend the rest of the time we got together on this facet, which is incredibly interesting. Mm-hmm. But the other feature of it which grabbed my attention was the, how do you say that? Well, let me just set it up this way, that if you described for me Anson's growing up experience internationally, I would say, hey, well, this is a guy who's, you know, a world citizen, and your point was that this connections with other parts of the world made him almost a super patriot. I mean, he would fight people who challenged his country.
Mm-hmm.
Even maybe when you'd argue that our country needed to be challenged, Anson was going to stand up for it, right or
correct.
Wrong, my country.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And did he tell that story correctly, Anson?
No, absolutely. And I think the angle Tim used, which was the correct one, is it made me an incredibly passionate women's national coach. And what I absolutely loved about coaching the U.S. women's national team, which I did from 1986 to 1994, I coached the team with almost the intention of being a foreign policy arm for the United States, because my entire life I've defended my country. And you're right. I defended it right or wrong. I mean, I'm the kind of patriot that I think any president would love to have, because it's almost irrational in the way I completely support everything that's American. But you're shaped by the environments you're in, because you end up defending it because you're attacked so often. And I was as a young boy, and I've always stood up for my country. And so being raised overseas, I mean, the irony is I certainly have a wonderful tolerance for all cultures and all peoples and all religious persuasions. And that's the absolute truth. And being raised in all these different places gave that to me. And I'm the first one to be upset that, you know, we've done so little about the Darfur and, you know, what happened in Rwanda. And, you know, I'm the first one to think that part of American foreign policy is to help these people that are being eliminated all over the world. So I certainly have compassion as a world citizen, but I also have a tremendous passion as an American coach, and I loved coaching the U.S. women's national team. And the best part about it for me was this is the world's game. Soccer is the world's game, and in this country, it's actually considered a foreign sport. And what I absolutely loved about coaching the U.S. women's national team, was defeating the world in its own game in the first Women's World Cup. And there was nothing more satisfying for me than that.
That half point of your life?
Well, one of them. I mean, absolutely. It was absolutely
what's
wonderful.
Close? What's close?
Well, because I love the university so much in Chapel Hill, I love any year that we can continue to succeed with a championship, a conference championship or a national championship, but also the way our kids have represented us. I mean, Mia Hamm has been a beacon for not just a women's soccer, but women's athletics, across sports, but also the empowerment of women. I mean, Mia's a great example of a strong, powerful, confident woman. And so I'm certainly proud of all of my graduates that have gone on to represent themselves in this university in the fashion that they have. And so there's so many different things. I'd be one-dimensional to share with you that my only satisfaction was that World Cup.
But I'm curious, Tim described a lot of your passions, including the one that you've talked about, your family, your team, America. Is there anything else that comes close that you're passionate about outside of those?
Well, obviously, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I think my dream when I'm done with my soccer career is to be a missionary somewhere for my church. And as soon as I can get all this competitive fire out of me, which hasn't died yet,
I'd hate for you to come knocking on my door.
I would love to.
But it's really interesting. This is a great thing about Mormon churches, that we think of the young people, 18, 19, going on mission trips. But one of the things that church has done is to provide the opportunity for retired couples to go out on the mission. And that's, gosh, would you come back and talk about that sometime?
Oh, absolutely. Hopefully it's coming back from Ethiopia as a 90-year-old. So, hang in there.
Great. Thanks to Tim Crothers and to Anson Durrance for talking about your book, Tim, and your life, Anson. Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.